It's here and now. President Bush is on the road today visiting New Jersey and Indiana as part of his 29-state push to sell his Social Security plan to voters and local politicians. The plan got a boost this week when Federal Reserve Board Chair Alan Greenspan made an unusual personal statement saying the country's fiscal woes demand immediate action on Social Security. That prompted an about-face by Republican Senator Bill Frist, who earlier had been waffling on support for immediate action. So now with his majority leader back in line, President Bush spoke this morning in Westfield, New Jersey.
Eventually, when you're spending at least $200 billion above and beyond that which you got in payroll taxes and increases every year, something drastic has to happen. If we act now, we can do so in a way that saves the system for younger workers. I'm going to tell you again, I'm going to keep saying it all around the country, and I like doing this, by the way. I like going around the country saying, folks, we have got a problem. And I like saying to people, don't worry about it. If you've been born prior to 1950, nothing changes. You're going to get what you promised. But I'm also saying to younger workers, you better listen carefully to this debate, because you're the ones who are going to have to pay for it.
Well, how long will he like going around saying that? The plan, which calls for private Social Security savings, has not gained widespread support. Not a Democrat in the House or Senate has signed on. Many Republicans have expressed their doubts, and voters are also skeptical. Here's Harold Schoenhorn at a town meeting organized by Senator Ted Kennedy in Boston today.
The way the Bush administration is going about it is the wrong way. And I think the public is beginning to realize that, even though he's going around stumping all over the country and pushing for it, it's just going to help big business, and it's going to take money away from the little guy.
Well, joining us on the line now is John Harwood, national political editor of the Wall Street Journal. And John, you know, some people are scratching their heads. President Bush obviously putting a lot of energy into his plan, even though it seems to be losing support rather than gaining support. Why? Why is he spending so much political capital on this right now?
Pretty simple, Robin. He believes in what he's advocating. George Bush is a conservative. A lot of people, when he first ran in 2000, weren't sure whether he was a centrist or a conservative, but in fact he is a candidate, a president of the right. He believes in moving this retirement system more toward one of individual risk and reward rather than social insurance. So he wants to change really the fundamental structure of Social Security, and that's what his private account plan does. Certain aspects of it are popular, but when you look at it in totality, all the things that are required both to maintain and achieve solvency and change to a new system, it's very tough to do, and he's discovering that.
Right. Many critics are saying it's a system that isn't as broken as he says. Well, he needs to convince voters. He also has to convince politicians. For example, GOP Rep. Mike Ferguson from New Jersey, where Bush is appearing today, and Ferguson has not endorsed the plan. How important is that aspect of President Bush's trip?
Well, one of the things that you can't do in politics, and certainly this president hasn't done, is forget about your base. He's not getting help from Democrats on this idea, and he's got to make sure people on his own team are in line and supporting him. And in terms of House members, people who may be in vulnerable seats, there aren't all that many of them, he's got to provide them some political protection. He saw this week that Bill Frist, as you mentioned earlier, raised the idea of delaying action on this. He quickly fell back into line, but that was emblematic of the fact that many Republicans are uneasy. After all, as has been observed many times during this debate, President Bush is no longer on the ballot. Those members of Congress are going to be on the ballot next November.
In the 2006 elections. Well, we remember how much arm-twisting there was in the Medicare prescription bill plan. Is it expected that that's going to happen now, too?
Well, there'll be a lot of arm-twisting, but that was a lot easier bill to enact than Social Security reform. Remember, the engine for the Medicare legislation was adding a benefit that was expensive. In fact, we're discovering now, or have discovered in recent months, that it's a lot more expensive than it was advertised initially. It's not that hard to get politicians to give something to their constituents. It's hard to get them to take it away, however, and what we've seen with private accounts is, though many Americans like the idea of private accounts, if you have to, in fact, reduce benefits both to finance the accounts and to make the system solvent in the long term, that is not popular, and that's what members of Congress are fleeing from at the moment.
John Harwood is national political editor of the Wall Street Journal. He joined us on the line from Washington, D.C. John, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, while President Bush and administration officials fan out across the country to stump for the president's Social Security plan, an army of online detractors is massing to meet him.
First, someone thought up the working lunch. Then we discovered the working vacation. And now, thanks to George Bush's planned Social Security benefit cuts of up to 46% to pay for private accounts, it won't be long before America introduces the world to the working retirement.
A new television ad produced by MoveOn.org features images of the elderly doing manual labor. And this week, the activist grassroots group announced a contest asking members to create an online ad attacking Bush's Social Security plan. So far, more than 1,100 people have signed up. MoveOn.org helped revolutionize the way politicians use the Internet to spread their message and raise funds. 3 million members have signed up, and more than $60 million has been donated. But MoveOn.org lost the last election, and Democratic strategists are wondering, has MoveOn moved too far to the left? Tim Dickinson explores what he calls MoveOn's online insurgency in the latest issue of Rolling Stone magazine. And he joins us on the line from San Francisco. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, thanks for having me, Robin.
And let's start by talking about this new ad contest. MoveOn sponsored a similar contest last year, as you write. About 1,500 people submitted anti-Bush television ads during the campaign. And MoveOn was criticized at that time.
Probably MoveOn's greatest mistake over the presidential campaign. They didn't manage to filter out two ads that compared Bush to Hitler, which weren't ads that were created by MoveOn. They were created by MoveOn members. But that the very fact that they aired provided the Sean Hannitys and the Rush Limbaughs of the world all the ammunition they needed to try to marginalize MoveOn as some sort of radical fringe group.
And ultimately, did their advertising effort and the millions of dollars spent have an impact?
It's difficult to judge. I mean, Kerry obviously didn't win, so they obviously didn't push him over the edge. Certainly, I talked to a Republican who worked on the Senate campaigns of three GOP moderates. His take on them was that they were absolutely ineffective in reaching out to the center and trying to rally the people in the middle. And his take on them is that they were less than useless.
And now we have the new Social Security ad, which we just heard a little bit of. It depicts senior citizens performing manual labor. It was paid for by MoveOn members. It was created by members. And you write about what you call this closed feedback loop.
Right. Well, that's one of the real tension between what MoveOn tries to do. They raise money from their own membership, their base, which by any reasonable judgment is a good deal more liberal than the rest of America. And in the presidential campaign, they were trying to speak to this very small center group. And the tension between an ad that's going to appeal to MoveOn's membership for funding purposes and then going to be sort of level-headed enough and the right tone and pitch and message for middle America is really pretty great. And then when you end up having MoveOn members creating the messages rather than, you know, media professionals who have a sense of what works in Scranton and Des Moines, you end up with a feedback loop of these people are not only paying for the ads, but they're creating them.
And you quote some of the leaders of MoveOn saying, well, we don't get around much. We tend to stay in front of our keyboards and do the work. So are you saying that the group is too insular and maybe too indebted to its millions now of funders?
I think that it's a little disturbing. I mean, in talking to them, and I think you have to preface any conversation we're having about MoveOn with some real piles of praise, because what they've done in terms of getting millions of people involved in the political process is really extraordinary. But I think MoveOn in many ways sees their own rise as a victory in and of itself, and I think they really don't get around quite enough to get the idea that what is appealing to their base, and especially the activist members of their base, who participate on the message boards, that those people aren't the same people that they're trying to reach. And there was a real sort of strange sense that I got in talking to one of the founders that he felt that they were the same thing, or that what appealed to the MoveOn base would indeed appeal to Main Street America.
What is MoveOn.org planning to do now? I mean, obviously they're fighting the Social Security plan, but what is their overarching goal?
Well, they're hoping to turn 2006 into a Gingrich-styled revolution for liberal Democrats in Congress.
Yeah. And what is the thinking about that from both Democratic and Republican strategists that you talk to?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the one thing that MoveOn did that was sort of less heralded than their advertising in the last campaign was a get-out-the-vote technique where they activated their members to get out from behind their computer screens and go out and stump door-to-door and talk to their neighbors and tell them, you know, why they should vote for John Kerry.
How is that different for the party?
The Democratic Party has traditionally relied on paid canvassers. And so America Coming Together Act and, you know, the DNC paid, I'm not sure exactly how many thousands of canvassers to get out there and knock on doors. And so the idea of having real unprofessionals going door to door talking to each other was much closer to the Karl Rove model, the sort of Amway-styled politics of the Republican Party.
Well, Tim, you spent some time with the very young leaders. There's only about 10 of them who are at the core of MoveOn.org. Who are they? What kind of people are they, and what was your sense of them?
Uniformly very smart, uniformly very idealistic. The man who's now the executive director is barely a man. He's 24. His name's Eli Pariser. He's very well-spoken, very earnest.
Isn't he the one who famously said, this is our party, we bought it, and we're going to take it back?
We bought it, we own it, we're going to take it back. He claimed that that message had been misinterpreted, that what he really meant to say was that the grassroots of the party, and not just MoveOn as an organization, but the grassroots of the party have bought the party and taken it back from the corporate special interest. But he also talked about the consulting class of professional election losers, you know, and there was certainly a sense of arrogance combined with a naivete that I think is really troubling to Democratic insiders who have been working at this long before Eli Pariser was in diapers. There's a sense of arrogance that suffuses what MoveOn does because they had an amazing impact and they have this huge membership, and they don't, to their credit, they don't try and lead the membership around too much. They really try and figure out what's important to their membership, but they bring a lot of force to bear, and sometimes that force is not too subtle.
What's your sense, Tim, having, you know, explored this, of the future of MoveOn.org? Is it going to be with us for a while?
It's a good question. I think it's an open question still as to, you know, how many people are just filtering out the email messages that they signed up for during the campaign. I mean, I know a number of people who MoveOn messages go straight to their spam filter. So whether their membership is actually 3 million, I would be very curious to know what their active membership is. But with each new issue, it seems that they are able to attract a new and different audience. And so if people are really, you know, juiced about Supreme Court justices or Social Security or another war coming with Syria or Iran, should that happen, I think MoveOn is incredibly well poised to keep growing and keep adding new and different members. Need to evolve and continue to play a very important part of the Democratic Party. And then plus with the ascendance of Howard Dean to the chairmanship.
Helped by MoveOn.org.
Helped by MoveOn. I mean, MoveOn can't claim very many victories, but that's one that they do claim. Here's someone who gets MoveOn, and MoveOn claimed that the first call that the new chairman made was to them.
Tim Dickinson is a reporter. His article on MoveOn.org, The Online Insurgency, is in the latest issue of Rolling Stone magazine. Tim, thanks for speaking with us about it.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
And just ahead, a newspaper editor goes down the blogger rabbit hole to chase a story the mainstream media was ignoring. There's more coming up here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. Remember our conversation with Jeff Gannon, a.k.a. James Guckert, the faux White House reporter for the GOP-backed website Talon.com? At the time, we asked him about early reports of his links to online porn sites.
About 5 years ago, I had a company that did website development. I had a private client who wanted us to register these sites and develop the websites. Nothing was ever put on those sites, and I can't even respond to all of it because I don't even know all of it.
Well, beware the bloggers. Within days, armchair sleuths running online weblogs unearthed nude photographs of Jeff Gannon and information indicating he was not telling the truth. Talon News fired Gannon and recently shut down the website, and he's now posting on his own blog. It's a story that's still unfolding and another example of the mainstream media following, even working, with bloggers. Greg Mitchell of the Industry Journal editor and publisher joins us now from his office in New York. And Greg, you've written that you watched the Jeff Gannon story unfold from day one and found yourself going down a blogger rabbit hole. Where did it take you?
I sort of followed it from early on, and I was able to see how the bloggers go at the story, and I guess somewhat to my surprise, how coordinated many of the activities are at the larger blogs. So you have someone who says, I've got leads on Jeff Gannon's connection to this outfit GOP USA, and I'm looking for who's on the board and when they were formed and so forth. And then down below, you've got people putting in information that they've gained. People go out on the internet, some people who might be lawyers or something in real life, are also join in on the blogs. They have special research skills, and they bring up information about where website domain names were registered. And
we understand that someone might be appointed a team leader.
Yeah, there were people at Daily Coast site, for example, who actually took on the almost like an assignment desk at a major news operation. So over the course of a couple of days, the people brought up not only this fellow's real name, but his business connections in the past, his political connections, entire list of groups that he might have belonged to, and then emerging things about sex sites he seemed to be involved with. To some extent, this kind of work, a lot of the mainstream media may not be inclined to cover. They may be too timid, or they may not believe this is something they should be doing. And I think that's part of the reason they don't get at some of this stuff. But also, to some extent, they can't match the sheer numbers of some of these blogs who can involve literally thousands of people who are willing to put in their free time to dig out information.
You say that as you were exploring these blogs, it helped you drive your magazine's coverage of the Gannon case. How so?
Mm-hmm. We would get information that was being alleged or facts that were emerging from the internet, which had not yet really appeared in the mainstream. And we were able to get exclusive interviews with a couple of interviews, actually, with Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, asking him about Gannon and to refute or confirm some of these things. And then we got an interview with Ari Fleischer, the former press secretary, who was there at the beginning of Gannon's tenure in at the White House. And we were able to present them with information. Now, in some cases, they refuted, and in other cases, they confirmed. Then we wrote about them. The bloggers then had a field day with, because they were saying things that hadn't come out before. So in a way, EMP was kind of a conduit between the mainstream media and the officials and the blogosphere. It's an example how in today's world, the bloggers are taken seriously, at least part of the time, and drive coverage the top news outlets.
These are unpaid, anonymous volunteers. These, what have they been called? Pajama Dean.
Yeah. Well, and many of them are highly skilled. I mean, yeah, some of them are wackos and don't bring a lot to the table, but some of them are very highly skilled. They have research skills from their other jobs or things in their past. They're very internet savvy, very computer savvy, and they can bring out information deeply embedded in the web that you and I could only dream of doing. And they can provide information that makes some people nervous, because it can expose personal lives, and anything you've written on the web or photos that may have appeared of you on some obscure site suddenly can be brought out.
The good news is that there's thousands of these people who unearth this information, but then you count on someone to pick the good from the bad.
Right. What I'm suggesting is that the people who have rejected the notion that the bloggers are, cannot be trusted at all, or are just filled with conspiracy ideas, actually they can produce a lot of good information. I think the bigger danger that I see for the mainstream is that increasingly individuals are becoming more and more partisan, and they are not open to news that might be right down the middle, or facts that they may disagree with. They're seeing everything through a partisan lens. So you're going to end up, a few short years from now, where you're going to have your liberal cable news and conservative cable news, and liberal network news and conservative network news, and local radio and talk radio and internet sites and blogs and everything else. And you'll have the country split down the middle, and no one being exposed to more objective facts and information in the middle.
We have bloggers that we stay in touch with here at Here and Now. Hello, Doug. And they're going to be a little upset by this comment, because my question to you is, when do you stop following the blogs? For instance, you talk about the Jeff Gannon story. We've got tons of emails being sent to us by bloggers about the latest rumor it's a rumor right now running around on the internet blogs that Jeff Gannon actually had something to do with the Rathergate issue, that in fact he might have been leaked the memo, that the memo might have been written by someone inside the White House just to bring down Dan Rather.
Right.
So when do you stop following a blog?
If you have the time, you follow it all the time. As a mainstream journalist, you can't ignore them and you can't accept it as gospel. The Jeff Gannon thing is just the reason I wrote about it. It's a great case study of both the tension between the mainstream and the bloggers, but also an emerging kind of cooperative spirit. And I think that's the way it has to be.
Greg Mitchell is editor of the newspaper Trade Journal, editor and publisher. He spoke to us from his office in New York. Greg, thanks very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, next week on Here and Now, how do you improve the high school experience for American students? Bill Gates says, break up those behemoths and set up small schools. Also, a kibbutz in Israel opens its doors to settlers from Gaza. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Two human rights organizations have filed a federal lawsuit claiming that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is directly responsible for the alleged torture and abuse of prisoners held by the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. The American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights First filed the suit on behalf of eight men who they say were tortured by forces who were acting while under the command of Rumsfeld. The Pentagon dismissed the suit, saying none of the investigations into the alleged abuse have implicated the secretary. John Hudson is dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center in Concord, New Hampshire. He's one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs in the case. He's also a former commander of the Navy's Judge Advocate General Corps, or JAG. And Hudson spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes.
Dean, let me ask you, first of all, this is not the first case connected with the scandal, the prisoner abuse scandal that broke in the spring. What do you hope to achieve with this new suit? And what's the point in naming Donald Rumsfeld?
Well, I'll tell you, this was very much a last resort. This was not the preferred way to go on this, but nothing was happening. You know, there have been myriad investigations into what happened at Abu Ghraib and other places, you know, where there are over 300 documented examples of abuse and between 35 and 40 death investigations. So that we didn't want to have to do this, but as long as the Pentagon was insisting that it was just a few bad apples that were responsible for this, then we felt that the concept of accountability required that something else be done. And so this was the avenue we chose.
And again, why name Rumsfeld himself?
Well, because I think that Secretary Rumsfeld sits behind the desk where the buck stops. He is the senior government official in the Department of Defense. He is at the top of the chain of command, and it was the chain of command that has let down the troops, I think, our troops, that has caused these awful examples of abuse. He's the one that's responsible, so that he's the one that should be named.
I should point out that Secretary Rumsfeld has apologized for the abuse, and the Pentagon has pointed out that none of the investigations thus far into the abuse have implicated Rumsfeld. What's your response to that?
Well, I have two responses. One is that talk's cheap. He has sort of superficially apologized, but nothing has really happened. There are, as I say, lots of investigations going on. But it was Secretary Rumsfeld who said many times that it's a few bad apples. And then Secretary Rumsfeld or his subordinates commission investigations to prove that point, you know, that's kind of the goal, is to demonstrate that it was a few bad apples. That is not the kind of investigation that is intended to really get at the root causes of the problems. You know, I think we've got problems right now. I spent 28 years in the Navy, and I say with some pain and regret, I think that there are some problems with recruiting, supervision, leadership, training, you know, the whole ball of wax. And so far, up to now, Secretary Rumsfeld and the Pentagon has not had the moral courage to really get to what the causes are.
I'm wondering, as a former admiral and commander in the Navy's Judge Advocate General Corps, do you feel that the Pentagon brass or the civilian command in the Pentagon has stuck it, so to speak, to the regular guy, the regular woman in uniform in these cases?
Well, I would say that's the case. You know, one of the great strengths of the military is supposed to be the civilian leadership, so that the military reflects the values of the society. I don't think the military right now, at least in this regard, is reflecting the values of society. And so I think that, you know, Secretary Rumsfeld has let us down in that respect. So, yes, that's true.
Dean Hudson, let me ask you this. Do you think the people who've been on trial so far and who've been convicted should not have been? Should they have been acquitted? Do they bear any responsibility?
Absolutely they do. I mean, they are indeed bad apples. There's no question about it. You know, Grenier, Frederick, the whole crowd committed despicable acts and humiliated themselves and the United States military. They certainly should have been court-martialed. Our only point is that given the chain of command, there are other people that are also responsible, and in many respects, in kind of a macro sense, even more responsible than the low-ranking enlisted people whose pictures you saw. Because nobody at the top of the chain of command said, they may be terrorists, they may be evildoers, but they're human beings, and we're Americans, and we will treat them with the dignity and respect that Americans treat human beings for generations just by reason of their humanity. Nobody made that clear statement. It was all, well, they're all terrorists, so different rules apply kind of thing. And that led inevitably to what we saw.
Beyond getting Secretary Rumsfeld to bear some responsibility for this, what does the suit seek for the victims?
Well, there are two things. One is what you just mentioned, a declaratory judgment by the court that Secretary Rumsfeld bore responsibility. And the other is unspecified monetary damages. We ask for compensation for the torture that these people endured, but don't ask for a particular dollar amount.
And hopefully, I assume, making sure this doesn't happen again.
And that's the whole point. That is precisely the whole point, is to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And that since the executive branch hasn't been willing to do it, have the judicial branch say this was a terrible thing and it must stop, or we're going to lose our soul in the course of winning this war. We can win this war. We will win this war. But we don't have to resort to torture in order to do it.
Dean Hudson, thank you very much.
That's quite all right.
Retired Rear Admiral John Hudson, now Dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center in Concord, New Hampshire, is one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs in a lawsuit over alleged prisoner abuse filed this week. Hudson, a former commander of the U.S. Navy's Judge Advocate General Corps, or JAG, spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. And this note about some of the stories we're following today: Syria's President Bashar Assad will reportedly go before Parliament tomorrow to say that he'll pull back all Syrian forces in Lebanon to the Bekaa region of Lebanon, not quite the full withdrawal of troops that President Bush and others are calling for. Assad's been under intense pressure to remove his troops from Lebanon after last month's assassination of Lebanon's former prime minister. Also, a poll by the Haaretz newspaper shows that a large number of Israelis support a plan by Prime Minister Sharon to evacuate the Gaza Strip and four settlements in the West Bank by summer. We'll have more on that story next week when we talk to a settler who's going to lose her home and to a kibbutz leader in Israel who's inviting her and her fellow settlers to move in. You're listening to Here and Now. Time to open the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts, and we heard many of them after our talk with AIDS activist Larry Kramer, who said gay men might have to change the notion of what is erotic in order to prevent the spread of AIDS. Jay Lassiter of Cherry Hill, New Jersey, represented the thoughts of many when he wrote, "Bravo. Larry Kramer's observations and suggestions should be a wake-up call for everyone. I contracted HIV as an 18-year-old in 1991 and spent the better part of the next decade addicted to crystal meth. So I can say for sure that the cautionary tale he delivers is pretty much spot on." But James Morris of Dorchester, Massachusetts, had this opinion. "I'd forgotten what a self-righteous, sex-hating scold Larry Kramer is. The problem isn't sex. The problem is ignorance and complacency. Those of us who were around at the beginning of the epidemic immersed ourselves in the medical data about the virus. Watching your friends die is a powerful motivator. Younger people have not had that experience and can't be expected to have the same reaction. What's needed is serious, real-world sex education before teenagers become sexually active. Larry Kramer's anti-sex hysteria is simply going to turn off young people and make it less likely that they'll listen to crucial, life-saving messages about the importance of safer sex and the deathly dangers of HIV. Well, we also reported last week on a move by Alabama Congressman Gerald Allen to ban all books that mention homosexuality, which brought this email from Jim Wire of Montgomery, Alabama. "You made it sound like the bill had any chance of passing. Do you think we're all idiots in Alabama? From newspaper editorials to rank-and-file folks, we all know how ugly and foolish this is. Allen is ridiculous, and we all know it. It's all about the Republican plan to use gay baiting and faith baiting for a crass attempt to steal power. We're not letting that happen, flat out. How about letting the rest of the world know, too?" Well, yesterday we spoke to musician Clark Wilson at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, home to a restored theater organ. Diane Balbett of Hollis, New Hampshire, called. Her mom is an organist as well.
"It brought back a flood of memories of my family going to Babson College to listen to theater organ concerts in the 70s and 80s. Dad loved the sounds of the organ so much, he built a theater organ in our basement with 16 speakers so Mom could play it. Our parents also used to drag us to a pizza parlor in Groton, Connecticut, called Pizza Pipes and Pandemonium, and the biggest reason I went was for the pizza. Thanks for airing this wonderful piece."
We also heard from many of you after our talk with Adam Robinson about the new SATs scheduled for March 12th. Leslie Sweetnam of Woodstock, Connecticut wrote, "Okay, it's not up there with the controversy over, say, juvenile capital punishment, but Adam Robinson raised the issue of pronoun agreement. The example he gave was everyone at the picnic brought their knapsacks, and he asserted that only his or her knapsack would be correct. Well, the Oxford Dictionary gives as its third definition for their, often used in relation to a singular subject, also used instead of his or hers when the gender is inclusive or uncertain, not favored by grammarians." Well, Leslie goes on, "These grammarians are the same folk who say we are incorrect to boldly go where infinitives are split and would burden us with the unnecessary his and her when there makes graceful agreement with the singular subject. To quote G.B. Shaw, it's enough to drive anyone out of their senses." In our conversation, we also quoted a critic of the written essay portion of the new SAT who said the new writing sections are as bland and as predictable as a middle-aged accountant, which provoked this note. As a middle-aged accountant, I realized that you were quoting a source, but gee whiz, doesn't anyone realize the value that my profession adds to everyday life? Cops and firefighters are heroes, but who do you think's responsible for getting them their police cars and fire apparatus that allow them to answer calls to 911? Sorry about this rant. I guess I need to retape my black-framed glasses, reload my pocket protector, and get back to my nerdery. Nerdery, a place where nerds toil. Tongue firmly in cheek, signed, John Hogan, Tucson, Arizona. Thank you, John. And thanks to all of you who wrote asking about my elderly dog, Mo. We're going to have the sad update at the end of the program. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now.
Two girls for every boy.
The towns of Huntington Beach and Santa Cruz are in a pitched battle over something sacred in sunny California. Which town is the actual Surf City? Santa Cruz claims the title, but Huntington Beach trademarked it. The rivalry goes back many years, and the title of Surf City is used to attract a lot of tourism dollars. So, at the risk of offending Santa Cruz, we're lining up with Huntington Beach, because that's where Dean Torrence lives, Dean of Jan and Dean fame. The duo had a big hit in 1963 with the song Surf City, and Dean Torrence joins us on the line now from Huntington Beach. Dean, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you. I had no idea that, I knew Jan and Dean had the hit with Surf City in 1963, but Brian Wilson wrote it with you?
Yeah, basically it was Brian Wilson's concept from the beginning. He probably wrote, at least half of it before he gave it to us.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, did you grow up in Huntington Beach? Did you surf there?
Grow up. Well, that
did you ever grow up?
I was going to say that's very subjective. I don't know. I spent a lot of my youth, preteen and teenager summer life here. I had actually had a pickup truck that I would carry around all my beach toys in. I would drive up to Huntington Beach and surf there until I got tired of it.
Did you surf Santa Cruz as well?
No, I had no idea Santa Cruz had surf.
Still don't, right? I mean, isn't that...
still don't. It does have an ocean and does have some pretty neat stuff. But
well, you know, Santa Cruz has accepted this challenge, and they say that Huntington Beach has gotten way too developed. There's huge hotels going up on the beach there. They like to keep it very simple, and with they have a lot of character there. You know what else they say? I mean, the insults are just flying. They say that they pride themselves on going to the beach without stopping to look at the mirror. Ow.
Oh.
Ow.
Yeah, but then they have to stop at the store to get a wetsuit.
Oh, because it's cold.
Yeah, very
cold. Further north.
Queen of the surfer girl.
You and Jan Berry, who passed away in 2004, he had a terrible car accident in 1966,
yes,
and you know, pulled through for many years and passed away just last year. But what were you and he, what were Jan and Dean and Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, what were you trying to say about that life in Huntington Beach and along the coast there in those songs that you wrote in the 60s?
You know, I'm not sure we were trying to say much. Anything at all, particularly? I know that sounds odd. Most of our friends that were recording were writing about, you know, girl and guy romantic things. And, you know, as I remember it, it was more a matter of trying to find something else to write about. And the only thing else that we knew about was kind of what we were doing day to day. Quite honestly, I'm not sure we understood that our lifestyle was all that radically different than from anybody else's,
right.
If you can believe that. We were California natives, and this is what we did every day.
You thought people in Indiana went out, and their hair was bleached by the sun, and they were tan, and they, you know, played hooky and went and surfed.
Isn't that weird? I mean, that's so wonderful when you think of it.
Don't be afraid to try the newest sport around.
You know, I have to be honest that we weren't sitting around going, you know, if we do write these songs about our lifestyle, there are a whole bunch of people that are landlocked somewhere that are going to be very much moved by this. We thought they would find it interesting, but, you know, maybe, or we hope they might find it interesting, but we didn't know we caused such a stir as we did.
Are you surprised that, you know, 30, 40 years later, towns are fighting over the title?
Oh, I'm thrilled. Oh, I think it's so cool. Hardly any of this I would have ever guessed would happen. And to be living in a city now that has adopted the name Surf City after the song, and I see it on license plate frames, and now more and more businesses seem to be adapting and using the name. It's kind of like living in my own little city. It's almost like I planned it this way, but I didn't. It just kind of happened.
Dean Torrence of the 60s supergroup Jan and Dean talking about the town of Huntington Beach taking Surf City, his song of the 60s, as their trademark. Dean, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Last week at this time, I talked about a difficult decision I had to make regarding a 19-year-old long-haired chihuahua named Mo. Well, last Friday night, sitting on the floor of my bedroom with a wonderful visiting vet named Jake and my dear friend Laura, holding Mo wrapped in his favorite blanket, I did the unthinkable and the necessary. I've never had a life pass through my hands before, let alone one I tried for years to save. Mo was the scrappiest, most tenacious creature I have ever seen. Along with his sidekick, Homie, he got into a lot of pickles, and I could always get him out until now. Boy, your many letters have helped. Cindy McManus, you got it just right when you wrote, "All the good things you did for your dog Boswell seem to disappear in your one final act of love for him." That's just how it felt. I also heard about dogs named Hercules and Katie and Carver. Pat Piper sent a New York Times article from 1979 in which Judith Wax writes about the dog she had to put down. "What can I say," she asks, "to be uncritically adored and blindly worshipped happens to be my idea of a good time." Now, my priorities are in order. Today, they'll bury my friend Agnes Salmon after a 95-year life well-lived. And I've been looking at old photographs of Mo playing with a toddler who's now 15, and this weekend we'll watch, fingers crossed, as she stars in her high school play. Now, I just wanted to let you know what had happened to a gutsy little guy named Mo. And if you are confronted with this decision, I wanted to report that I'm starting to believe Jake the vet, who says pets sometimes need our permission to leave their posts. So, permission to stand down granted, Mo. As Edith Wharton said, "My little old dog, a heartbeat at my feet." Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.